Hello, this is Chuck Stevens, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 22nd edition of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our first article, Shutdown with No Clear End Poses New Economic Threat. The effect is rippling beyond missing paychecks to federal services that support much of the economy. The economic effect of past government shutdowns has been straightforward. The economy loses some activity for a few weeks, then gains it back after the government reopens. The net cost is basically zero. This time, the math may not be so benign. As Washington's stalemate continues into its fourth week with no end in sight, it's looking like this could become one of America's longest funding lapses. During the previous record holder, a 34-day closure in 2018, Congress passed enough appropriations bills to keep more of the government funded. This time, none have been passed. And the White House is attempting to lay off thousands of people and threatening to withhold back pay for furloughed workers, despite a 2019 law requiring that they be paid. That would obviously make it a larger macroeconomic impact, said Michael Zindiak, a director on the United States economics team at S&P Global Market Intelligence. Then there are services those workers aren't providing, including national park tours and new drug reviews that support commerce. For many businesses, the timing couldn't be worse, with the holiday season approaching and economic uncertainty already high. If you're worried about the potential for those indirect impacts, those only increase the longer the shutdown goes on, Mr. Zindiak said. Economists estimate that the shutdown will trim between 0.1 and 0.2 percentage points off annual growth in economic output for each week it drags on. That amounts to between $7.6 billion and $15.2 billion a week based on hours that government employees aren't working, according to Oxford Economics. The 2018 shutdown trimmed slightly less than 0.1 percentage points off annual growth per week, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. That estimation does not capture the ways federal services support economic activity in other sectors, where the effect could be narrow but deep. Consider visa processing. Much of it is performed by contractors, who were told to stop work on October 1st. Unlike government employees, they will not be paid back when the shutdown ends. Brandon Muniz owns a Maryland information technology provider, Haytech Services, which relies on federal contracts. He has already lost business this year because of government cost-cutting, and over the past couple of weeks, he had to cut hours for staff members who can't evaluate applications for green cards and employment-based visas until the government reopens. Mr. Muniz has had to lay off 15 people this year and furlough another 25 because of the shutdown. He worries about getting them back if they find other jobs and keeping the business afloat in the meantime. All of our indirect costs for our headquarters team, the facilities, the vehicles that they have, we still have to pay for, Mr. Muniz said. Those are things we factor in when we write up a proposal for a contract, but it's very difficult to factor in something like a shutdown. The individuals and businesses that Haytech serves, like farmers, operators of seasonal attractions, and seafood processors, are dealing with delayed visa applications. Small companies that depend on one or two foreign workers with specific skills are in limbo, said Mark Neuberger, a lawyer with Foley & Lardner in Miami, who helps clients with labor issues. Even a short shutdown gums up the works for months, and they have to clean up the mess from when they were gone, Mr. Neuberger said. The federal government also guarantees a significant share of credit markets through agencies whose work has been significantly curtailed, including the Small Business Administration and Department of Agriculture. The pause in federal loan processing poses the biggest obstacle for low-income borrowers who would qualify for a mortgage backed by the Agricultural Department's program for rural areas. But even people with approvals for private mortgages in disaster-prone areas are getting tripped up because they have no access to the National Flood Insurance Program. For farms and small businesses, October is a critical month for borrowing money. Some are paying their taxes, having gotten a six-month extension from the spring. Others are trying to stock up on inventory or purchase equipment for the upcoming planting season. Federal agencies generally offer more affordable terms than private lenders, and if they're not available, borrowers may resort to pricier options. They will try not to invest money or hire more people right now, said Rohit Arora, the chief executive of Biz2Credit, an online lending platform. If that doesn't solve the problem, credit cards come first. But there will be a subset of customers who will be forced to borrow at a much higher cost. The timing for the shutdown is problematic for another reason. Monetary policymakers are fumbling forward without critical labor and inflation data produced by statistical agencies. The economy is already approaching stall speed and being battered by tariffs and aggressive immigration enforcement. Missing signs of a more serious downturn or an acceleration could lead officials to make a decision on interest rates that they might regret when the data becomes clearer. Federal data informs smaller decisions, too. The Department of Agriculture produces weekly reports on production and global demand that help farmers decide where to market their crops and what to plan next year. This is not a great time for the lack of information, said Todd Davis, the chief economist with the Indiana Farm Bureau. Farmers are trying to make business plans, pacing their production, whether they want to sell it at harvest or make decisions on storing and carrying it into later this year or early next year to find a higher price. Janet Lowry, 75, a former professor, has been furloughed from her part-time position as a field representative for the Census Bureau in Southwest Indiana, a $15 an hour job that provided some extra income to supplement her savings. She said the lost data was even more important to her than the missed paycheck. One program she is responsible for is the monthly survey of construction, which requires calling builders in Fort Smith, Arkansas, to see how many housing units they've added and when they will be completed. That's used by all kinds of people to determine what's going on in our economy in that area, the need for new appliances and the amount of housing available, things like that. Ms. Lowry said October is blown. Like the federal workforce cuts that President Trump has already imposed, the pause in government operations is most acutely felt in the National Capital Region. Virginia has already lost 10,000 federal jobs this year, is forecasting an overall contraction in employment for 2025 for the first time outside of the pandemic since the Great Recession. The lost jobs and paused wages are leading more people to seek food assistance, according to the Capital Area Food Bank, which has opened extra sites this week specifically for federal workers going without pay. Rosie Allen Herring, the chief executive of the region's United Way, said there was another problem. Federal workers have historically given generously to the organization through the combined federal campaign. The period when they would typically be deciding what they will give next year is coming up. Those contributions that we were counting on to help those who are already in need are in jeopardy and have been diminished, Ms. Allen Herring said. Now what do you do when someone who used to be your donor becomes a client? There are many other ways that suspended government services could dampen economic activity. Permits aren't being issued. Research grants aren't being processed. Construction contracts aren't being executed. Products aren't being vetted. If ships start to back up at ports because of short staffing at custom offices, perishable goods could spoil, and airline delays are mounting. But some of the more serious ramifications come from risks that aren't being managed. It's hurricane season, for example, and small disasters can become larger ones if National Weather Service can't warn communities about a storm, and if the Federal Emergency Management Agency isn't at full force to respond. David Bernstein, a consultant with a firm called BSI, who helps companies plan for emergencies, said businesses could confront disruptions beyond the variables they normally tracked. That realm of influence has to grow wider and wider because you can't control all of those things that are happening, Mr. Bernstein said. And you're going to start to see those cascading impacts coming through. In a related story, how Trump played budgetary twister to pay some workers during the shutdown. By paying troops and law enforcement officials, the president stretched the limits of his spending powers, posing a fresh test to Congress. Tucked among the many pages of President Trump's signature tax cuts is a single paragraph that provisions money for the Department of Homeland Security. Totaling $10 billion and created to help safeguard the border, the funds received scant attention when Republicans in Congress adopted the mammoth law this summer. But the money has since taken on greater significance as one of the obscure accounts that have enabled the White House to manage the fallout from the government shutdown. 3 weeks into the fiscal stalemate, the Trump administration has taken a series of unorthodox steps to reprogram billions of dollars in enacted spending, marking an escalation in its campaign to wrest control of the budget away from Congress. The moves, which are highly unusual during a shutdown, have allowed the president to pay military service members, immigration agents, and other federal law enforcement officials, even though lawmakers have not approved new money for their wages. Normally, federal workers do not receive income until the shutdown concludes, creating hardship for millions of troops and civil servants who are either furloughed or forced to keep working without pay. But the White House has stretched its authority in recent days to assist certain employees who are seen as central to Mr. Trump's political agenda, including those who conduct deportations. Using a set of funds in the president's tax law, the Trump administration has promised pay to thousands of ICE agents and other law enforcement officials who otherwise would not have received checks while the government is closed. And for the troops, Mr. Trump has turned to a special set of funds meant to develop weaponry while ordering the Pentagon to explore other sources to pay the military throughout the shutdown. Few in Congress have publicly challenged the president over his recent actions. Given the broad bipartisan desire to spare government employees, especially the troops who are caught in the middle of the funding debate. But many legal scholars, budget experts, and congressional Democrats remain uneasy with Mr. Trump's expansion of presidential power. They view it as just the latest instance in which the White House has encroached on congressional authority, one that could open the door for Mr. Trump to reprogram the budget in more drastic ways once the shutdown ends. The White House tests the waters, said Shalanda Young, who served as the leader of the White House Budget Office under President Biden. Ms. Young said the administration would look to assume greater control over the power of the purse for as long as Congress refused to assert its authority under the Constitution to chart the nation's spending. This White House is not going to stop until Democrats and Republicans choose to put the instinct ahead of partisan warfare, she said. Russell T. Vogt, the director of the White House Budget Office, recently described the effort to pay troops as playing budgetary twister to find a pot of money that has a similar purpose that we can pay them. It does have an impact on how long this can go without having severe repercussions, Mr. Vogt said in an appearance on the Charlie Kirk Show this month. In its novel work to reshuffle the budget, the White House has further revealed its shutdown strategy 21 days into the standoff. The administration has labored to help constituents Mr. Trump likes and boost programs he supports while maximizing the pain for Democrats who refuse to submit to the president's fiscal demands. For weeks, Democrats have rejected a Republican proposal that would reopen the government into November because it does not extend a set of expiring health subsidies, which help millions of Americans pay for insurance with prices set to skyrocket soon. The two parties have made no progress toward resolving that impasse, while Mr. Trump has been all but absent in trying to broker a deal. After a series of failed votes in the Senate, lawmakers in the chamber this week are set to consider a backup plan, which would restore pay for military service members and other federal workers who serve in vital federal roles. But some key Democrats have already said they would reject the approach, describing it as limited and insufficient. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the minority leader, criticized the bill on Monday as more like a political ploy to pick and choose, giving Donald Trump discretion, which employees should be compensated and which employees should not be compensated. All employees should be compensated, Mr. Jeffries continued at a news conference, and that will happen when we reopen the government. For the moment, federal workers are sorted into three categories. They are furloughed, forced to work without pay, or essentially exempt from the shutdown because their salaries come from funds already enacted by Congress. Furloughed workers in particular number into the hundreds of thousands. Since the shutdown began, Mr. Trump has signaled them he may try to deny these employees automatic back pay, even though the president signed a law during his first term that would provide it. In other cases, Mr. Trump and his top aides have proved more willing to bend the rules. To help the troops, the Trump administration tapped a set of leftover funds at the Defense Department for research, development, testing, and evaluation. That money is typically used to help the military refine weapons and develop other tools of war. But the Pentagon moved to reserve $8 billion from the account to pay active duty military members their full checks this month. Days later, Mr. Trump directed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to use any funds appropriated by the Congress that remain available to pay the military over the remainder of the shutdown. The scope of that order was sweeping, potentially giving the Pentagon great leeway to reconfigure its budget to ensure service members do not miss their checks. Explaining its approach in a memo to Congress, the White House this month appeared to assert vast new authority to reprogram money during a shutdown, according to a copy viewed by the New York Times. Mark Paoletta, the general counsel of the White House Budget Office, said that funds approved by lawmakers for one purpose could not ordinarily be used to backfill another, completely different account. But Mr. Paoletta argued that the accounts to pay military service members no longer exist as a matter of law now that federal funding has lapsed. That, he continued, allowed the administration more leeway to shift money around to pay for its priorities. Mr. Paoletta then offered a series of examples, many from the late 1700s and 1800s and some involving times of war, in which he said that presidents had spent without clear authorization from Congress to address emergencies. Siren Lingdon-Savage, a lawyer at Project Democracy, an open government group, said the Trump administration's actions raised serious legal questions. Typically, she said, funds can be moved around only if Congress gives the president the authority to do so. A violation of that principle compromises the most fundamental tenet underpinning Congress's power of the purse, he added. But Mr. Trump and Mr. Vogt have long argued that the executive branch possesses great power to control the nation's spending, with the ability to defy lawmakers' budgetary instructions at times. The two men have already shuttered entire federal agencies and canceled or frozen billions of dollars in funds enacted by Congress in moves that have prompted dozens of lawsuits and open federal investigations. Days after paying the troops, the Trump administration then moved to source additional funds to pay nearly 70,000 federal law enforcement officers across the federal government. Like military service members, these workers, which include immigration and customs enforcement agents, had been required to continue reporting for duty without pay during the shutdown. The administration promised checks soon to border enforcement officials, including those at U.S. Customs and Border Protection, certain correctional officers at the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and special agents with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Secret Service, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, according to congressional aides. To pay them, the Trump administration appeared to route the funds from two specific branches of money that Republicans approved as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the president's tax package, according to two people familiar with the matter. They spoke on the condition of anonymity to share information that the White House has not publicized. One fund totaling $10 billion was set aside for the Department of Homeland Security to reimburse its work to safeguard the borders of the United States, the law specifies. Another totaling about $3.3 billion was allotted to the Justice Department to combat drug trafficking and illegal immigration and defend the Trump administration against lawsuits in court, according to those familiar with the plans. Because these funds are limited in some ways under law, the administration appeared unable to use the money to pay all of the employees at a given agency, essentially creating a new class of worker in the shutdown. Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, said last week that the administration would pay some law enforcement officials at the Transportation Security Administration. But the budgetary maneuvering did not appear to include the thousands of workers who screen bags at airports for security threats. Similarly, only some of the correctional officers at the Bureau of Prisons are set to receive pay, while many must continue reporting for duty without it, according to personnel and email records viewed by the Times. David Super, a law professor at Georgetown University, who studies the budget, said it was unusual that Congress even approved money in this matter as part of the tax bill. He said the legality of its use hinged on an unanswered question. If the Trump administration only paid law enforcement officers whose jobs fit the criteria outlined in the law. But Mr. Super raised a broader, lasting concern with Trump's actions to pay some government workers during the shutdown. By taking arguably the most important power away from Congress, the power of the purse, he's going a long way toward making Congress irrelevant, he said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Well, you may have heard our second meat raffle is coming up on Friday, November 7th at the Main Transit Fire Hall. Presale tickets and verified veterans pay only $10. Others are $15 at the door. You can get a table of 12 for just $100. Admission includes two beers, unlimited soft drinks, a 4x6 U.S. flag to wave on Veterans Day, and a chance to win from a huge selection of delicious meat and raffle prizes. Tickets are very easy to purchase and help fund the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. To grab your tickets, nfradioreading.org. Very simple. You just click on the button, and off you go to get your tickets. Next up, opening a restaurant in New York is no picnic. Here's what it takes. If you ever wondered, it's the fantasy at the back of so many people's minds and maybe yours. You quit that boring job, cash in those savings, and open up a restaurant where you can indulge your love of cooking and spend evenings with devoted regulars. Well, the reality isn't as pretty. Trying to create a restaurant from scratch is a huge gamble, and in New York City can feel almost impossible. Astronomical rents, stiff competition, and city bureaucracy make the process an obstacle course. Yet, a record 4,557 restaurant permit applications were filed with the city last year, many of them by deep-pocketed owners and big-name chefs. We sought out the underdog, a first-timer risking it all to pursue the dream. Someone who had never recruited investors, landed a liquor license, or scaled up a recipe for hundreds of diners. Could she succeed? Or is the city's dining scene simply too rough for a rookie? Here's how her effort has played out, step by step, since she began a year ago. She imagined this move for a long time, but felt daunted by the process and her lack of any experience working in one or even cooking. What she does have is personality. Her name is Molina. She's upbeat, organized, and unshakable, well-suited for the unpredictability of restaurant work. She decides to put a big chunk of her savings into the project and understands there's a good chance that she will fail. Finding her other half, well, over brunch in December, Molina asks her friend, Alex June, age 45, a no-nonsense pragmatist, who runs the Brooklyn coffee shop Shea Alex, if she'll partner on the restaurant. Alex, who immigrated to New York from Poland in 2002, wants to flex her cooking skills, and she agrees on the spot. So what's the big idea? Molina's vision is the kind of restaurant she's always wanted in her Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood. a casual all-day cafe serving food inspired by her Bengali heritage, where diners can drop in without a reservation. A place that people in the neighborhood go to that is warm and friendly when you don't want to cook for yourself. Naming the restaurant is the easy part. Shani means sugar in Bengali and Hindi, and she likes its melodic sound. With an MBA from the University of Chicago, Molina knows how to pitch people on an idea. She and Alex draw up a list of their selling points. They know the neighborhood well. Brooklyn doesn't have many Indian restaurants in the middle space between takeout and fine dining. The borough's casual sit-down restaurants are often hard to get into. To gain experience and a little cash in January, Molina starts bartending at Moot Bar in the Bed-Stuy area. She gets regulars excited about her plan and learns to pour a beer with just the right amount of foam. Molina and Alex start discussing a business plan over dinner at Damaka, an Indian restaurant in Manhattan. They agree to invest $30,000 of their own money and raise $100,000 from friends and family. But their emailed pitch to about 25 potential investors in March elicits a tepid response. Many friends are buying houses, or having children. Eventually, eight investors come on board, including Molina's father, Pratap Khan, who puts up $15,000, and her sister, Alicia Khan, with $10,000, along with several friends who invest $2,000 to $10,000. Well, this brings the woman's budgets up to $176,000, including $59,000 they can put on their two business credit cards with no interest. February 2025, with cash in their coffers, Molina and Alex are ready for the next big step, finding a space. They decide to open in early summer. Landing an affordable New York rental is notoriously tricky. With a budget of $4,000 to $6,000 a month, the partners hope for a space with an ample kitchen and room to seat 30 on a street with lots of foot traffic and few other wine bars or cafes. They also like to walk to work. It's winter, and the pickings online are slim, but they find three strong contenders. Number one, it's big, bright, and costly. Address at 485 Tompkins Avenue, rent $7,100 a month. It's a pretty block, easy walking distance from Alex and Molina's apartments. Alex comes across this space while jogging. It's brand new, with nice light, a backyard, a spacious basement, lots of pedestrian traffic. It lacks a kitchen, so the women will have to build one, and the rent is over their budget. The second property, it's a turnkey with a catch at 564 DeKalb Avenue. With a rent at $5,500 a month, rather, plus a one-time payment of $250,000. It might be tough to share space with another business, but it already has a kitchen and a bar. Formerly a neighborhood restaurant called Barron's, this feels the most ready of the three to move right into. The current renter has even offered to transfer the liquor license to Molina and Alex. But the renter runs a special events business and wants to continue using the kitchen. He'll cover some of the rent, but asks for another $250,000 since he has already paid to convert the space for a restaurant. The third property is cozy and affordable at 395 Nostrand Avenue with a rent just a little over $6,000 a month. It's already got a kitchen and has a lot of potential in room for renovation. This charming brick-walled space used to house a bar called Corners, and the price is right. But the hardwood floors need finishing. Natural light is minimal, and Molina finds the low ceilings basement a little creepy. Still, the money saved on rent would allow her to invest more in sprucing up the room. So, which one did they pick? Well, we'll tell you in a minute. Now the paperwork. Having spent years navigating the healthcare system, Molina easily handles and even enjoys filling out all the forms. She takes the food safety course so she can get a food handler's license. She and Alex find a contractor to build the kitchen exhaust. He introduces them to an engineer to file for the landmark approvals. Molina isn't even bothered when the state liquor authority grants and then rescinds the wine license over a minor technicality, which eventually did get approved. For the LLC membership certificate, the $50 fee is the first charge to their credit cards. The food protection certificate, the course Molina takes, requires her to memorize the names of various bacteria. That sounds like fun. Health inspection certificate, because of a staffing shortage at the city's health department, Shaney can open without an inspection and get one later on. Landmarks preservation permit. Their application is initially rejected because their photos of the building were not taken at the correct angles. Wow. And the wine and beer license cost them $1,060. So now it's construction time. Meeting with contractors, Molina and Alex realize the build-out will cost more than $200,000, which they don't have. So they turn to two workers who won't cost a bit. They're romantic partners. Tenille Joachim, known as TJ, Molina's boyfriend, a stand-up comic, has building experience, including working as a contractor for TaskRabbit. And Armstrong June, AJ, Alex's husband, a jazz musician, co-runs Shay Alex and helped with its construction. They'll erect walls in the back of the place to house the kitchen, then build the kitchen bar and custom benches attached to the walls. AJ and TJ create the kitchen by installing two walls in the back of the restaurant, easy enough, as they frame that out. Or not so easy. AJ and TJ spend all day building the bar out of birch from Home Depot. But to sit at it comfortably, you'd have to be more than 6 feet tall, like the two men. That sets off an argument with the women, but ultimately, they rebuild the bar. Well, then there was a thief in the night. Someone breaks in, sleeps behind the bar, takes two circular saws, and defecates on the floor. Welcome to New York City. AJ and TJ promptly install a security gate in the basement. Plumbing is a hassle. The women find a plumber to set up the sinks and dishwasher, but he charges $14,000 and takes his sweet time. In May of 2025, as the space starts to take shape, Molina and Alex turn to the decor, but a June 1st opening date is now looking impossible. In New York, design budgets for some restaurants can stretch well into six figures. These partners have just $14,000. Their goal is to evoke Molina's colorful family home in Kolkata, India, which has a breezy feel like a veranda. With their budget, their approach is decidedly DIY. So, the women shop for paint and earth tones, pale yellows, browns, and dark greens. Who ends up painting the restaurant? Who else? AJ and TJ. Molina and her sister, Alicia, spend a weekend at home upholstering bench cushions using their mother's old saris. Molina makes a mood board full of details inspired by her Kolkata memories, elegant archways, floral wallpaper, and pendant lights. Much of it is beyond her price range, so she'll have to be creative. Molina and Alex spend hours trawling through vintage stores like Mother of Junk in Williamsburg and Bedford Galleries in Bedford Stuy, where they find inexpensive rattan chairs and paintings that match the hues of the benches. The streets of Brooklyn are a trove of discarded gems that can be used to decorate. At a construction site, Molina finds an impressive mirror and an instant pot. Alex makes a rare discovery at a repair shop, a $20,000 La Marzarco espresso machine from Italy, selling used for $6,000. So the two men carry it over to Shaney. Another budget-friendly idea from Alex, pasting faces of famous South Asians, including the actors Kumail Nanjiani and Mindy Kaling, on the bar. Listening to the French Open on a phone, AJ and TJ construct tables, hang paintings, and install the lights outside. And it's all about the brand. The restaurant already has a name, but how to get someone walking by or scrolling Instagram to quickly understand what the place is all about and stop in. Molina has an idea for a mascot, a monkey holding a wine glass. She reaches out to a friend who runs a creative agency. The quote that comes back is $25,000 for a logo, menu design, and signage. Too much, so back to the drawing board. A friend, Rajiv Mitra, who is a product manager but not a designer, asks ChatGPT to draw a logo, then changes the fonts to look cleaner. Another friend, Nick Botter, offers to try his hand at a logo for just $200. His first try is stylized and architectural, but not quite bold enough. His second option is colorful but too busy. Well, the women love Nick's rendition of the mascot, but decide to pair it with Rajib's fonts, creating a logo that's playful but direct. Shani, coffee, wine, Indian-ish food, in green with a caricature of a monkey on the logo. Molina then creates an Instagram account for Shani, but she barely uses her personal account, and Alex doesn't use social media at all. So Molina spends most of the day watching YouTube videos to learn how to create a multi-paneled Instagram post. Molina loves making playlists. She decides on a mix of Bollywood and pop. I want the daytime to be fun and casual, like songs you could sing to, she says, and the evening to be more loungy. The women decide not to hire anyone to run publicity and marketing because they can't afford it, and are hoping word of mouth will draw people in. They'll have to do all of their social media. So in June, the moment has come for the most critical decisions of all: what to serve and whom to hire. The opening date is pushed back again to buy more time. The new opening date, July 1st, 2025. From the start, Molina has wanted to serve Indian dishes with a nostalgic feel and some modern twists. But Alex, who will head the kitchen, has never cooked Indian food. So for a lesson in Indian cooking, the two partners and TJ visit Molina's parents in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. But Molina's mother, Musumi, isn't sold on the restaurant idea and urges her daughter to reconsider. Musumi makes kachuri, made by stewing lentils and rice, chopped spiced fritters of ground meat, and shimi kebabs, which Alex says tastes like chicken nugget. So they decide on a menu, a blend of traditional Indian dishes and a few items that remix classic Indian flavors. So one of the drinks, a sweet, sour, and slightly spicy green mango drink called Ampana, a tea ramasu, biscuits dipped in masala chai and layered with cardamom cream, and the list goes on. Then it's time for help wanted. It's summer when the city empties out. Alex worries about finding enough people, so she and Molina cast a wide net, posting the job on Culinary Agents, Craigslist, and Job Today. Base pay is $20 an hour, higher than the $16.50 minimum wage in New York City, but allowing room for raises. They hire 11 people. Over the next weeks, they fire a cook who almost adds bacon to a vegan dish, and a server who turns out to have little experience. So that leaves 9 employees. Cam, the server and barista, Jess, the server, Charlie, a cook, Anjala, server and food prep, Jensen, a cook, Balu, a barista, Catherine, a barista, Anna, a cook and food prep, and Heather, a barista. In July, could it be, Shani is finally ready for customers. For the first time, Molina and Alex commit to an opening date and start the run-up. The opening date, July 16th, 2025. The first hurdle is friends and family, as it's known in the business. It's a dress rehearsal to allow the staff to practice for a sympathetic audience. So it happens on July 12th, which is a Saturday. Just 2 days before the big night, the restaurant is still filled with trash and tools and dust. Alex is trying to learn how to use an Instant Pot. Strangers keep throwing their trash on the Chinese patio. Somehow, everything comes together. The night arrives, and if by magic the place is clean, fully decorated and filled with flowers. At 6 p.m. sharp, Melina's parents show up. Her mother sobs tears of joy at seeing her old Saris. "We were so scared," she says, "but it's amazing." About 75 guests arrive around 6:30, including some who didn't RSVP. So the atmosphere turns from calm to frenzied real fast. All the orders seem to pile in at once. Charlie and Alex are frying chop and stuffing pechuga, sweat streaming down their foreheads. Guests keep peeking into the kitchen to say hi. The exhaust system hasn't been installed yet, so the air quickly thickens with smoke. At the pass, servers can't tell which dish goes to which table. Finally, the last orders reach the kitchen, and the cooks high-five as the restaurant clears out. Alex pours generous glasses of wine for everyone. The team is exhausted but happy that the crowd seems to have loved the food. Still, a few changes need to be made. A longer curtain to cover the kitchen entrance, a sign marking the bathroom, and a better organized dish station. In total, the night brings in $2,337. Looking over the orders, Melina realizes the total should be closer to $5,000. Some guests apparently forgot to pay. So we're open. Melina and Alex have 4 days to clean, fix the glitches, and get Chenille ready for its public opening. They've installed a printer in the kitchen to create paper tickets that can help servers match each dish to a table. Another improvement, a walkie-talkie system to connect the kitchen upstairs with the prep area downstairs. The day of the opening on July 16th, Alex arrives at her coffee shop at 4 a.m. to bake pastries for Chenille. They're placed under a glass case, and at 8:02 a.m. the restaurant opens. The rest of the day is slow because the owners didn't advertise. There's no sudden rush at the door. Those who do stop by are mostly from the neighborhood. Despite the trickle of customers, the restaurant runs out of most dishes by 9 p.m. And customers seem excited. There is this trend of a very similar restaurants opening up in this neighborhood, particularly new Americans, said David Kirschberg, a designer who lives nearby. It's nice to have something that's quite different. His girlfriend, Miriam Brito, who works in healthcare communications, has been waiting for months for Chenille to open. "I think this neighborhood embraces different," she says. "I don't think there's such a thing as too different." So they did it. They opened a restaurant in less than 8 months. Now for the hardest part, staying in business. July and August are sleepy, but it's summer after all. Just before Labor Day, the owners meet with the staff to review the state of affairs. So far, Chenille has broken even. To boost sales, they make some changes, including half-price glasses of wine during late night hours and an increase to the price of chai, their best-selling item. September brings a swift uptick. In the first week, revenue jumps 34% over the previous week, then 18% the week after that. Nights are still slow, but Melina and Alex have built a small base of regular customers. They've started paying themselves the same $20 an hour they pay their employees. Business may not be booming, but like so many restaurateurs, the two are already thinking about expansion. Maybe Manhattan, Alex suggests, or another part of Brooklyn. Would they really want to repeat the entire laborious process? It's been exactly 1 year since Melina left her old job, where the salary was generous and the work predictable. Now she's not sure what next week will bring, much less next year. Still, she feels she's just where she wants to be. "I am way happier," she says. "Totally worth it." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A reminder, set your calendars for Friday, November 7th, the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service meet raffle at the Main Transit Fire Hall. Presale tickets, $10, and you can grab them right now, nfradioreading.org. From the reporter's notebook, Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska has a risk, but he's proving it paid off. A new 37-track box set released alongside a biopic tracking the making of his 1982 album underscores how sometimes a musician's first recording is the right one. Demoitis, that's the term producers and musicians use to describe their frustrating attempts to recreate the raw purity of the first realization of a brand new song, the demo. When demoitis sets in, they labor endlessly to copy the intensity of a newly minted vocal line or the tone of an instrumental quirk or some other happy studio accident. Even as multiple takes push the initial spark even further away, they strive to reproduce some indefinable spirit and ambiance that get captured in the moment. Countless songs have been fleshed out, pumped up, embellished, and improved along the way from demo recording to official release. That's a huge part of a pop musician's craftsmanship, and every major musician's studio catalog is likely to be dwarfed by the number of rough draft recordings that fans never hear. But since 1982, there has always been the great counterexample, the indisputable proof that sometimes demoitis is no delusion. Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. The Nebraska album Springsteen chose to release in 1982 was the bedroom-recorded lo-fi product of his one-man arrangements. Guitars, voice, harmonica, and a little more. The songs were constructed on limited and iffy equipment. A four-track Tascam 144 Portastudio cassette recorder that was mixed down through an Echoplex reverb to a water-damaged Panasonic boombox that ran at the wrong speed. And I'm old enough to remember some of that equipment. That's from Eric Flanagan liner notes on the new Nebraska 82, a 37-track box set that delves further into the album's story. It's the latest deep dive into Springsteen's seemingly inexhaustible vault of unreleased recordings. After the release of seven full albums on tracks two, the Lost Albums, earlier this year, Nebraska 82 proves that Springsteen made the right choice. The fragile, solitary, imperfect tone of the demos captures and suffuses the spirit of the songs. But the expanded album also unveils some striking outtakes and might have been. Springsteen clearly sees Nebraska as a crucial, mission-defining moment in his career. The box set arrives alongside an earnest, authorized biopic, Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, that focuses on Nebraska as an artistic and psychological turning point. Springsteen has been actively promoting the movie alongside Jeremy Allen White, who plays his 1980s self. For the songs that became Nebraska, Springsteen has expected to work as he had on previous albums. He'd bring the basic demos to his expert road-tested E Street band and let them fill out his outlines. The new box set reveals what they came up with, the band's solidly professional and sometimes rowdy new takes, and songs that would reemerge on later albums are billed as Electric Nebraska. The Electric Nebraska sessions in the new box include a real find. It's the primal, cranked-up take of a song Springsteen held back, the openly desolate minor key precursor of his all-conquering 1984 blockbuster single, Born in the USA. The 1982 demo version, with hard-strummed, reverb-laden guitar, has already been released on Springsteen's 1998 compilation, Tracks, and Springsteen has revisited that version on tour. But the electric version on Nebraska 82 has an elemental power, a throat-tearing vocal above a stark, stomping band, Downbound Train. Another song, remade for Born in the USA, gets revved up too. It was different, Springsteen said in a phone interview. The strange thing was, I cut the band down to a trio. I have no idea why, but I just used guitar, bass, and drums on a lot of the Electric Nebraska stuff. I went after this very primitive sound, which I really hadn't pursued. I forgot entirely that I ever did. When he rediscovered the recordings, he said, I was shocked at how it sounded. I don't know where I was going with it exactly at the time, But you know, looking back, I remember I was disenchanted with it. But now, hearing it this far down the road, I said, well, that was pretty good. It was probably the most primitive that the E Street Band has ever sounded. But those tracks stayed in the vault, and Nebraska arrived as an unexpected turn inward before the explosive extroversion of Born in the USA would make Springsteen a superstar. Punk had already emboldened lo-fi recording experiments, but Nebraska would encourage many more mainstream performers to honor their demoitis. Springsteen made Nebraska after repeated breakthroughs, including the brash Word Drunk Do or Die and perfectly over-the-top Born to Run in 1975. The steadfast Up From Delusionment, Darkness on the Edge of Town in 1978, and the sure-footed and thoughtful The River in 1980. For Nebraska, Springsteen's artistic impulses led him away from the sound he had honed with the E Street Band. The songs on Nebraska continued the kind of terse, character-driven storytelling that Springsteen had used on The River, but the stories they sketched were even bleaker. They are all but drained of hope. Reason to Believe, which ends the album with a half-smile, recognizes the stubbornness of optimism, only to reveal its futility. Springsteen has said the songs are grounded in his love of film noir, with its moral impasses and dead-end fatalism. Many of the album's characters self-destruct, not even spectacularly, but in vain. The narrator of Nebraska, who is awaiting execution after a pointless murder spree, can barely explain his actions, and he sums up the album's lessons in a line. I guess there's just a meanness in this world. The way the E Street Band worked up the demos didn't sound right to Springsteen at the time, even though they might have seemed more radio-friendly. Instead, the album arrived as something more modest, haunted, and immersive. Nebraska 82 includes demos of songs Springsteen would omit from Nebraska and later rework or salvage lyrics from Child Bride, which would yield verses for Working on the Highway, and the phrase Meanness in This World for Nebraska, and Losing Kind, a distant relative of Highway 29, on The Ghost of Tom Joad. In Gun in Every Home, Springsteen explores a sense of fear and alienation behind the facade of a comfortable suburban life. The set also unearths On the Prowl, a driven Chuck Berry-style rocker played solo with not quite finished lyrics, as Springsteen sings about searching, searching, searching for a wild, wild child. The echoey guitar and vocals create a manic, spooky tone. Fans have long been curious about the discarded electric Nebraska sessions. They reveal the kind of camaraderie the E Street Band has always added to Springsteen's songs, transforming them into jaunty teamwork. On the Nebraska songs, their playing is solid, attentive, and skillful, and as Springsteen realized, simply not quite right for these songs about desperate estrangement. Nebraska became a soothing folk rock ballad. Mansion on the Hill hinted at a hymn. Atlantic City suggested a boy's night out, while Johnny 99 emerged as an upbeat romp, splashed with honky-tonk piano. The sound was richer, cleaner, more comfortable, but comfort wasn't what the songs demanded. Filling out the Nebraska 82 box, Springsteen revisited the album on stage this year for a concert film, performing the songs at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. The arrangements were similar to the album. Two very discreet backup musicians quietly added instruments heard on Springsteen's four tracks, like a glockenspiel or a second guitar. There was no audience in the theater, preserving the album's sense of isolation. The film is black and white. The recording is somber, pristine, and respectful. But the Nebraska original still holds something more, something that was preserved on the narrow tape out of that humble 1982 cassette. Maybe it's noise or imprecise tape speed or the limitations of a microphone or the acoustics of Springsteen's bedroom. Maybe it's the tentativeness of testing new material. Maybe it's the way the songs sound like they're being overheard rather than performed. Whatever it was, Springsteen heard it and was wise enough to let the world hear it too. And let's wrap up with today's edition of the New York Times with a look at film. Over the weekend, you probably heard, a group of burglars stole 8 pieces of priceless jewelry from the Louvre in broad daylight. The common refrain, the shocking heist, was like something out of a movie. It brings to mind the youthful robbers of Jean-Luc Godard's new wave masterpiece, Band of Outsiders, in 1964, causing havoc by running through the famed museum. Some have compared it to the Netflix series Lupin, which features the central character lifting a valuable necklace from the same institution. Well, if real-life crime has you itching to watch some fictional versions, here's 6. 1966, How to Steal a Million. Audrey Hepburn in that one. 1999, The Thomas Crown Affair. 1981, The Great Muppet Caper. In 1991, Hudson Hawk. Bruce Willis was in that one. 2018, The Ocean's 8 movie. Amazing. The whole set is amazing. 2025, something called The Mastermind. So, you know, on a rainy afternoon, evening, or morning in Western New York, might be something to check out. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 22nd, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chuck Stevens. As always, thank you for listening.